Forum on the Hill. From 4 to 6 p.m. each day this week, we'll talk with lawmakers, educators, health professionals, and local leaders in an effort to promote collaboration on community-wide issues. Let's navigate the path forward together. Presented by Alliance Health, Chapel Hill Transit, Durham Technical Community College, Grub Properties, Trinsic Residential Group, and UNC Health. The Forum on the Hill. Only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com.
Welcome back into the Forum on the Hill here on 97.9 The Hill. I am Brighton McConnell, and we're moving into our second panel of the day. About as equally as important as K-12 education, it is health and wellness. We know that this has been top of mind really across the country for the last year and a half, and has always been an important topic, especially within our community, knowing the people who work here and who our different health organizations serve. We've got two great guests to talk about health and wellness with us today. Joining me on one side of the room, we have Crystal Schiller, who's a professor in the UNC Department of Psychiatry and the co-director of the Perinatal Psychiatry Program. We also have Dr. Mehul Mankad, who is the Alliance Health Chief Medical Officer. Thank you both so much for taking the time to join us here on the Forum on the Hill. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, Brighton.
Absolutely. So I think people have gotten to know health and wellness a little bit better than they did about 2 years ago. At the same time, I do want to offer you both some time to share a little bit about your organizations and your programs. And I want to start with you, Crystal. Can you share a little bit of the work that you do at the Perinatal Psychiatry Program? What does that entail?
Yeah, we offer a whole range of psychiatric services to pregnant and postpartum women in the Perinatal Psychiatry Program. So I work closely with psychiatrists, social workers, nurses, nurse practitioners to do evaluations of women who are struggling during pregnancy and the postpartum period. And really, it's gotten much tougher during the last couple of years as COVID has surged, waxed and waned, because women are really doing this much more in isolation than they ever have before, which has really created a mental health crisis for pregnant and postpartum women. I also am part of the UNC Wellbeing Program, which provides psychiatric and mental health support services to healthcare workers throughout the UNC system. So we've really tried to tailor a lot of new programs and treatments to healthcare workers who have been struggling with trauma and just a lot of stress during the pandemic.
Well, definitely going to be talking about that a good bit during this hour. Turning to you now, Dr. Mankad, can you share a little bit about what Alliance Health is? Because it's a relatively new health organization in our community and across the state, right?
Absolutely. So, I'm Mehul Mankad. I'm a psychiatrist, chief medical officer at Alliance. And we are a managed care organization, but for a very specific population. And so the people that we serve are individuals with severe mental disorders, intellectual and developmental disabilities, and it's a targeted approach to some of the most vulnerable people in our community.
Yeah. All right. Well, I know that that's Orange, Durham, Wake. There's some other places where Alliance is
available
too, right?
We've been working in four counties for about 12 years, and we're so happy last week to have expanded our reach and are now serving people in Orange County.
Got it. Well, you kind of start us off where I'm hoping that we can begin the conversation, Crystal, in terms of talking about how the pandemic has affected both of your fields and your patients. Obviously, it has changed a little bit how people are viewing public health and all that stuff, but I also think it's changed how people are viewing mental health, which was already a changing discussion before the pandemic truly hit. But can you each share how the pandemic has directly affected what you're working with? And you already alluded and shared a little bit of this, Crystal.
Yeah, we're getting many, many more referrals now than ever before. And I think that's for a couple reasons. I think stress in general, environmental stress, increases symptoms of mental health problems. And so we're seeing depression and anxiety rates skyrocket. right now. So some people are talking about a second epidemic or pandemic of mental illness that's happening really around the world. And so we've also simultaneously seen a lot of payers being willing to pay for virtual treatment for mental health conditions now. And that has enabled a lot more people to access care than ever before. Coming in to, you know, UNC Hospital or outlying clinics is difficult for a lot of people, but especially women with young children and people with severe persistent mental illness. And so the barriers to care are now lower for a lot of people than they were before. Simultaneously, I think we've seen a decrease in stigma around mental health. And we're seeing people reach out for treatment and care a lot more readily than ever before because everybody, it's happening to everybody.
Right, yeah. Right. And same question to you, Dr. Moncott. I mean, how has Alliance Health seen its operations and how it's helping its patients change right. over the last 18 months?
So if you kind of think about us very narrowly as a payer, the piece that is revolutionary on the payment side for healthcare is that really the vast majority of managed care organizations pivoted quickly to seeing telecare, you know, telemental health or telehealth of various types as equivalent to seeing your healthcare provider in person. And so honoring that and making sure that the right thing to do for the person is the easiest thing to do for the person is something that we've been very excited to be on the forefront of.
Yeah. Let's talk about 2 years of stress and fatigue on people's minds, because I think that we're reaching a point now where we are adjusting to this new normal, but obviously have not fully gotten back to what we would all consider normal. And who knows whether that is the case. I'm sure, Crystal, that is probably affecting many of the people that your programs typically help, because there was already plenty of stress in day-to-day life, and now we have this on top of it to where we might not be able to go back to how it was before.
That's right. So I think we can all think about the pandemic as being both a chronic stressor and a series of acute stressors. So we can't get used to the new normal because we're coming up against new stressors all the time and new information. So just when we thought that pandemic rates were, you know, going down and people were going to be able to go back to some semblance of normalcy, then the Delta variant surged. And then that passed. And now we're coming up on the Omicron variant. And I think that impacts families and people in all sorts of different ways, especially our healthcare workforce, and just feeling so burdened and burnt out in dealing with all of this. So, yeah, I think, you know, there is no new normal yet, and hopefully we will come up on some semblance of normalcy sometime soon. But in the meantime, it's just about sort of coping and learning tools to promote resilience.
You mentioned working with UNC health workers during this time, too, and that is a group that is having a very unique experience right now, because some people, I think, really struggle to comprehend the magnitude of the pandemic on public health in general and what the results of COVID-19 in our country and the world have been. But there's probably few communities that feel it more directly than healthcare workers. So what are some of the things that you've been hearing from them? I imagine it is similar burnout, but almost at an even more intense rate.
That's correct. So at the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of healthcare workers rented hotel rooms and lived outside of their normal living environment because they were really worried about bringing the virus home to their children and families. And so, you know, some people would describe going home and stripping off all their clothes on the front porch before going inside and showering, and just living with a really high level of stress that they might infect others. And some of them did infect their families, and that was a really high price for some folks to pay. Since then, we've had people leaving healthcare in droves because the stress is too much. And there are other jobs where they can make similar pay for much, much less stress. The people who've stuck around are therefore working much longer hours than ever before and having to work in environments that are much more stressful, with lots of PPE and taking care of very, very sick patients and under conditions, you know, where, you know, patients aren't necessarily taking the advice of medical professionals. And so they're turning around and saving the lives of people as best they can, even though they didn't take their advice to begin with. And I think that's created a lot of moral distress and just rampant burnout across the system. And so, it's been really challenging, and that challenge continues. It's not over yet.
What is your perspective on how things have been going on the healthcare worker front, Dr. Moncad, for Alliance?
I couldn't agree more. I think, to Dr. Shilla's point, the great challenge is that to be a highly skilled clinician who's competent to work in a COVID unit, for example, whether it's on the inpatient unit or even on the intensive care unit, takes years of training. And then to be met with the experience of rejection by potentially the patients that they're serving or by society at large for the efforts that they do day in and day out, in which they risk their own lives and the lives of their family potentially, absolutely is a kind of injury. And some people are kind of describing this as a moral injury. And so we are seeing challenges with staffing and inpatient units having difficulty working at full capacity. And so then that kind of creates a vicious cycle and can compound the problems that we already have.
We're speaking with Dr. Mehul Moncad of Alliance Health. He's the chief medical officer for them. Also in studio with us here on our health and wellness panel is Crystal Schiller, who's a professor in the UNC Department of Psychiatry and also the co-director of the Perinatal Psychiatry Program. And you both were alluding to how things were already stressful before COVID came along too. Are there parts of healthcare and parts of maybe even like working on the front lines or in mental health resources that because of us adjusting to this new reality of living with the coronavirus, still being in a pandemic in some sort of form, look like they could now be permanently strained from the response that we are seeing when it comes to mental health?
Certainly the resources will be strained for quite some time. I don't think there's any quick fix to any of this. And so many people are working very hard to try and address work shortages and the trauma that our healthcare system and healthcare workforce has faced. But it's going to take a really long time, quite frankly, to come back from this.
One of the populations that I'd like to highlight, you know, we pay a lot of attention, as they do deserve, to our nurses, our doctors, but a population I'm particularly concerned about are our semi-skilled healthcare workers. And so in some areas, they're called direct support professionals or DSPs. They might be CNAs that work in nursing homes. But these are individuals who are towards the bottom of the pay scale. And with the labor shortage throughout the United States, they have to make real life decisions. You know, do I risk my life working in this environment for the same $15 an hour or less that I could make working in retail? And so that is a harsh reality that I think we need to confront as a community.
You both have now mentioned the labor shortage, and we've done some stories here at 97.9 The Hill about some models that UNC Health ran even before the pandemic was here about what that is going to look like on the nursing side, but that's a great point of how many other labor shortages there are too. And as I think Dr. Moncad mentioned, it just compounds the fact that these people who are working in these high-stress environments but critically important environments are now being asked to do even more than before. How challenging is that?
It's incredibly challenging. A lot of people are relying on these jobs to feed their families, and so they stick with it. At the same time, I think many people feel a sense of contribution to something bigger than themselves, and that's an important reason that people are sticking with these jobs, because it feels like it really matters to do this work, especially during a pandemic. But, you know, everybody is sort of weighing that equation for themselves. Is it worth the risk to myself and my family to continue this job? And also factoring in the cost of healthcare, or childcare, rather, during the pandemic, many parents left the workforce because it was more cost effective to stay home than to pay for daycare.
Have you? Go ahead. I was going to say, has Alliance Health been hearing anything on the regards of people who feel the burden, of course, not just making sure that their community and their patients are safe, but also the people that they have at home, their loved ones?
I think that's a concern for so many of us, whether you work in healthcare or not. There is that question, if I go out of my house and I'm in public with others, you know, what am I going to bring back home? And it's probably compounded for those who are in, you know, not just healthcare, but in so many fields where your job requires you to be in close contact with the public, whether it's working in the grocery store or as a server in a restaurant or what have you. I think one analogy that I've seen, which, and you know, this may upset some of your listeners, but I'm not a big fan of using military equivalents for describing this. So on the one hand, yes, it does feel like a war. On the other hand, nurses and doctors and people that work in service fields are not soldiers. They probably trained in the jobs that they have well before COVID, and they're doing this as a choice, maybe out of altruism, and they want to help people, but not necessarily because they want to sacrifice their lives. And so I'm less happy to make that comparison than I've kind of seen with, like, you know, yard signs planted in the lawn.
I think that makes some sense. And turning back to you, Crystal, and knowing that your program and you've been talking with people who specifically are kind of on the front lines. Sorry again for that phrase, but for people directly dealing with the pandemic, I'm curious, can you talk to, or have they spoken to, the mental toll of having to constantly be in that level of PPE? Because I imagine some people might look at it as, oh, well, they're taking so many precautions when you go to healthcare settings or hospitals, I suppose specifically, that maybe they should feel extra safe. But at the same time, having to go through all of that every single day, every single hour that you're there, probably also takes a pretty heavy mental toll.
It does, and I've especially heard that from midlife women who are dealing with hot flashes. Wearing PPE is really uncomfortable for a lot of them. But I think people are feeling grateful for the PPE that they have now, because they didn't early in the pandemic. And I think that was much, much more stressful than on the healthcare workforce than having adequate PPE, which they have now.
Got it. Well, I do want to talk a little bit more about mental health resources that are available. And I think that talking about the telehealth part of it, as both of you have mentioned, is certainly a very helpful resource there. But is there, have you been hearing from patients or from mental health experts whether that is kind of a good equivalent or whether that has its own challenges to it? Because I'm sure those exist too. And that's kind of an open question to either of you.
Sure. I actually have been collaborating with some of my colleagues in the psychiatry department to embark upon a systematic review and meta-analysis of the existing literature on this topic. Because when the pandemic hit, we were really wanting to do right by our patients and know whether or not telebehavioral health was as effective as in-person care. And so we're now getting ready to submit the results for publication. But what we found was that telebehavioral health is as effective as in-person, face-to-face mental health care. And in some cases, it's more effective because the barriers to care are actually lower for most people. That being said, not everybody has access to high-speed internet, and so that's been a real problem. And some of my colleagues in the department have really been trying to identify strategies in partnership with Alliance and others to get smartphones and technology into the hands of people who need it most, because it really improves quality of life. Not only does it enable them to attend virtual healthcare visits, but having internet in a home is really important to be able to connect to our culture and society more broadly.
Well, do you want to build off that? Because I know Alliance Health and their patients probably experience many of those barriers too.
So I'm so glad that Dr. Schiller has had the personal experience of doing telehealth, because I read the same studies. I also read that the researchers say that it's as effective and sometimes more effective, but it's good to hear that authentically that bears fruit. Obviously, we can't do everything over tele, right? Like you can't do like a COVID nasal swab through the screen, but there's a lot of things. There's more things we can do now than we really ever thought. I was listening to one pediatrician talk about how they did a school physical for a child who wanted to start sports through telehealth. So really things that we were just not expecting to be able to do safely. We do have a little bit of our own data, and the population that we serve at Alliance is not a privileged population. And so one of the things they struggle with, not all, but many, is transportation. One of the nice things about Chapel Hill is the transportation system. But even if you have access to the bus system, think about what I was saying earlier, where the right thing to do needs to be the easiest thing, and that those two things have to align. If you're a mother of young children and you need to come in for therapy because you're suffering, you've first got to find babysitting for those children, get on the bus, make sure you get there early because you want to then get to the appointment, walk to the appointment, check in, see your therapist, and then do the whole thing in reverse, and then pay for the babysitter. So much of that has vanished if you can do it through tele. And so what we found when we did a small-scale study at the beginning of the pandemic, when we converted to telehealth, is that our no-show rate for the people that we serve went down, not up. It went down by 40%.
Wow.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, that is impressive. Do you want to build off of that?
Yeah, I'm seeing the same thing in my patients. And actually, many of my patients now meet with me right from their beds. So another large barrier to coming in to therapy is you have to feel well enough to do it. And so when you have severe depression, it's really hard to do anything, much less get out of bed. So I'm actually seeing many of my patients from their beds, and we can do therapy from there. And it's been great. Many of our mothers who are our patients have always brought their kids in to their appointments because it's been impossible for them to afford childcare. And so I'm used to taking care of women with multiple children in the room, and that's just not really been possible during COVID. So I think telebehavioral health hopefully is here to stay. It's been one silver lining of the pandemic.
I was going to say it is interesting to see how those silver linings pop up. It does seem that even though there are some struggles sometimes to technology and internet access, in many ways this is kind of opening any doors. And we are going to be hitting our break here in a little bit, but to kind of put a bow on the COVID part of the conversation, from either of your perspectives, is there anything else in the last 18 months when it comes to either mental health access or healthcare access along those lines that the pandemic has kind of highlighted, shown good or bad? And I'll start with you, Dr. Moncott.
Yes. And so to me, the pandemic serves as a stress test for our healthcare system. It highlights the best aspects and where we can rise to the challenge. So, for example, you know, when we needed to convert waiting rooms into ICUs and, you know, kind of take care of the most acute needs of our population, UNC and other healthcare providers in the area absolutely rose to that challenge. However, that stress test showed us that there were other parts of the healthcare system that really didn't respond well to that stress. And so serving the most vulnerable people with mental and behavioral health disorders was even more challenging during COVID than it has been previously.
And turning back to you, Crystal Schiller, same kind of question. What are some of the shortcomings or some of the silver linings that have been reflected over the last 18 months?
I would agree with everything that Dr. Moncott said. I think it's been a stress test for the entire system, and we have, you know, lost on my own psychotherapy team. We've lost a number of providers who had to stay home with children with high needs and just weren't able to see patients all day and homeschool at the same time. And I think that tension of being a working parent has been difficult for many for a long time, and the pandemic really brought that to the fore. At the same time, I have a really dedicated group of clinicians that remain and feel very passionate about the work that they're doing, and we're innovating and doing new things to try and meet the needs of our patients every day. So I'm really more proud than ever to be part of this team.
Looking forward to continuing this conversation in just a few minutes. We're talking with Crystal Schiller as well as Dr. Mehul Moncott. You're listening to The Forum on the Hill here on 97.9 The Hill. We'll be back right after this break, continuing our health and mental wellness panel.
Stay tuned for more community conversations on The Forum on the Hill, only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com. From 4 to 6 p.m. each day this week, we'll talk with lawmakers, educators, health professionals, and local leaders in an effort to promote collaboration on community-wide issues. Let's navigate the path forward together. Presented by Alliance Health, Chapel Hill Transit, Durham Technical Community College, Grub Properties, Trinsic Residential Group, and UNC Health. The Forum on the Hill, only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com.
Chapel Hill Transit is now hiring. They're seeking energetic, passionate, and mission-driven individuals to drive their buses. If you have a great attitude and great customer service skills, they want to meet you. No experience is necessary, and Chapel Hill Transit offers paid training and excellent benefits. Full and part-time positions are available, and they offer flexible shifts. Find out more online at townofchapelhill.org/jobs. Again, that's townofchapelhill.org/jobs.
From star athletes to superfans, UNC Health is dedicated to caring for champions of all kinds. For you, the latest advancements and our greatest expertise are always in play to deliver personalized care with the utmost compassion. It's the kind of care that keeps champions like you and your family in the game when it matters the most. See our lineup at unchealthcare.org/sports.
Jerry and Tina Bell have lived in Chapel Hill for more than 50 years, but still have a fondness for their first home, a cozy two-bedroom apartment in the iconic Glen Lennox neighborhood. Bell remembers carpooling to campus in a loud 1955 Hudson, and Tina recalls sharing wonderful walks with the Baby Carriage Brigade. Read about the Bells and other residents over the last six decades, such as Bland Simpson and Roy Williams, in Glen Lennox Stories in the Town Square section of chapelboro.com.
Trinsic Residential Group, the firm behind the Aura development, is proud to sponsor a new monthly segment, the Nonprofit Spotlight. Each month, Ryan Stewart from Trinsic will invite a worthy nonprofit from our community to our station to explain their mission and message. Trinsic Residential is committed to placemaking, best-in-class planning, and construction practices in supporting our community. Thank you, Trinsic Residential Group, for supporting our local nonprofits.
Orange County residents looking for an affordable way to continue their education can pick up a new skill or change careers with courses at the Durham Tech Orange County campus. Located in Hillsborough, students have access to healthcare programs like anesthesia technology, EMS, and nurse aid, as well as courses in photography, sewing, computers, and English or Spanish. Visit durhamtech.edu to learn more.
If you live in Orange County and are insured by Medicaid or have no health insurance, meet Alliance Health. Beginning in December, we'll be your bridge to care for mental illness, substance use disorders, and intellectual or developmental disabilities. We're already on the ground listening to community leaders across Orange County to learn how we can work together to manage quality care that helps folks thrive and live their best lives. Visit us today at alliancehealthplan.org.
Welcome back to Community Conversations on the Forum on the Hill. See the full schedule of forum topics by day and catch up on anything you missed at chapelboro.com/forum on the hill.
Welcome back into the Forum on the Hill. I'm Brighton McConnell. We are continuing our health and mental wellness panel here with Dr. Crystal Schiller, a professor in the UNC Department of Psychiatry and a co-director of the Perinatal Psychiatry Program, as well as Dr. Mehul Mankad, who is the Chief Medical Officer for Alliance Health. And we talked a little bit about this, or I mentioned it off the top before we hopped into our COVID-19 pandemic stressor conversation, but it does feel like in recent years that mental health has become a little bit less of a taboo topic to openly discuss. I'm curious, and that's from my complete removed and you know, novice side of this, but I'm curious from your perspective, Dr. Schiller, is that true when you talk with patients? Is that something that people are a little bit more open to discussing, and has that made a difference in how you all are approaching mental health and patients?
Care. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that there's been less stigma around mental health issues in recent years, in large part because of the pandemic. But even prior to that, as you said, I think with more celebrities coming out and talking about struggles with mental health, as well as it just being something that younger generations are more open to. So Gen Z, for example, is much more open with talking about mental health issues. And I think that's had a ripple effect on some older generations. And that's actually been really helpful in people coming to seek care and being open about the symptoms that they're experiencing.
I would agree completely. The data for Gen Z or the younger millennials is different than what we've seen with any other generation. Right now, the students who are undergraduates across the country, about half of them have an open chart with student mental health. That doesn't mean that they're all in weekly therapy or are taking medicines or what have you, but they have a connection and they're willing to speak in a way that no generation in the past has. On the far other end of the spectrum, potentially, at least in the way that some people might think about it, in the veteran population, about half of the veterans who go to the VA to get care, about a third of the veterans who go to the VA to get care also have an open chart with mental health. And so we are seeing these changes, and I think that spells something good for our society.
I obviously don't want to speculate too much if there's nothing to back it up, but in your perspectives, is there some sort of correlation to why that might be for the younger populations? I don't know if it's, there's always the conversations around it. Could it be the technology? So people just have easier access to talk with each other about these problems. Is it growing up during very turbulent times? Although everybody's always grown up in turbulent times. I mean, I'm sure there are so many different factors to it, but do you, either of you, have any thoughts on maybe why that is, that the younger populations are typically the ones driving the conversations these days?
I don't really know. I haven't seen any good data about this myself, but I think that there have been you know, public relations campaigns and celebrities have come out. I remember when Brooke Shields came out to talk about her own experience with postpartum depression, it was extremely controversial. And now celebrities are coming out with their own experiences with postpartum depression, it seems, all the time. And so I think public figures have really done a lot to push the conversation forward and make it seem okay to talk about these things.
I wonder if there is an element of social media where, you know, I, at least as a parent of two teenagers, I often see social media as uniformly evil. But in this case, with the low barrier for social media influencers to talk openly with the people that follow them, you know, if they bring up topics that make their vulnerable elements kind of clear, that may lower the barrier for the people that consume their content.
And kind of along the lines of lowering the barrier too, I think it's talking more about how and when people should reach out for help. I think, and it's been pretty clear that the stigma around mental health used to be, oh, somebody is sick. But now it's just, well, if you're not feeling okay for whatever reason it is, don't be afraid to reach out. In your mind, Dr. Schiller, working with mothers, is that something that they try and continue to get over, is knowing when it's okay to reach out and ask for help in some way?
Yeah, that's a question that I get quite frequently. So when folks are finding that they're having difficulty carrying out their normal day-to-day activities or functions, or are just feeling distressed, feeling sad or hopeless, helpless, anxious all the time, and it just feels uncomfortable, that's a time to reach out for help, because we have really good treatments and they're more accessible now than ever.
And same kind of question to you. In your mind, is that an easier question to address now, or in your mind, how and when should people be reaching out for help, Dr. Moncad?
It's such a great question, and the answer is it's kind of staring us in the face, right? If you're an individual and thinking, I'm wondering if I should talk to somebody about what's going on with me, the answer is yes. There's no harm in talking. Whether that begins in kind of a graduated way, so maybe the person reaches out first to a family member or a trusted friend or a clergy or what have you, taking those steps and letting go of the shame or guilt or feeling of being a burden, and allowing yourself to share that intimate information that you think makes you different and less than, is absolutely an important thing for us to do.
And it's also important to note, Dr. Schiller, with your research too, there are a lot of discussions around, well, it's not somebody's fault that they're feeling this way. It's also so many factors that cannot be helped. And we were actually just talking during the break about some research you have done, and recently getting a grant to take a look at this even further, especially when it comes into women's health.
Right. So the biggest message that I often give women is it's okay to be not okay, and to ask for help. And there are a whole bunch of factors that contribute to depression and anxiety during pregnancy and the postpartum period. That's the focus of my research. So in the transition to menopause, I study reproductive transitions in women and sort of the biology that puts women at risk for depression and anxiety during those times. So our research has really shown that hormones, the hormonal change of pregnancy and the postpartum, is enough to trigger depression and anxiety in women. That being said, a whole bunch of environmental stressors also come along with pregnancy and postpartum, any big life transition. And on top of that, there's the stress of the pandemic. And so all of these things contribute to depression and anxiety. And so it's okay to feel not okay during this time and to ask for help. Historically, women were told that this is the best time of life and that you should be happy to have a healthy baby. And people are still getting that message today. But there are a lot of factors that contribute to symptoms during this time that are way outside of a person's control. And so that's why, you know, I have a job to help sort that out and figure out how to help.
And as hoping to build off that a little bit more too, it's usually things that are linked together that help kind of create those multiple mental health concerns, right? It's really just one thing that you can point to and say, oh, this is why you are feeling sad, or this is why you're feeling anxious. It's so many factors that are joined.
Exactly. And so my research, funded by the National Institutes of Health, actually tries to isolate the effects of hormones so that we can see, for some women, why is it that that change is so problematic? And so what we do is we actually give women hormones either to try and improve their mood or to try and see if they're sensitive to the effects of changing hormones. We give hormones to turn depression on and off, actually, in women. So we have a couple of studies in which we're doing that right now. But you're right, that's what makes studying this complicated, because none of these factors occur in isolation. It's always a combination of, you know, big life transition, biological change, and it's a perfect storm for mental health symptoms.
It's fascinating, challenging. There's so many different ways to approach it, but thank you for sharing some of that. I want to turn back to you, Dr. Moncad. While talking about it and examining it in that way is half of it, and we've already been talking about just access to mental health resources. That's the other big part of it, too. And I know that that's a big reason why Alliance Health is doing what it is trying to do, making sure that people who have disabilities, making sure that people who really struggle on a day-to-day to get that access are able to have several resources and providers to reach out to. Can you share a little bit more about that?
The great challenge and cruelty about struggling and suffering with mental disorders is that it's precisely that organ in your body that is the one that's supposed to help you then make that appointment and get you there and to keep going back. That's tough. Imagine, you know, if you have a pain in your elbow and you want to see someone for that. Your mind is not the barrier. There are other barriers maybe to getting care for that. So you're absolutely right. Getting access and getting timely access and getting access to the right kinds of clinicians is the piece that we focus on as much as we can. And, you know, the self-serving part of that is that if you don't provide access to people that's comfortable and easy, then they're going to end up in the emergency room. They're going to end up with, their physical health deteriorating. There is that mind-body connection. Even worse can happen. You know, sadly, over the past 120 years since epidemiologists have been tracking this, suicide has remained in the top 10 causes of death in the United States in that entire time, with one year that's an exception, and that's this year. It was pushed to number 11 because COVID is the number 3 cause of death in the United States. But when that passes, suicide sadly will likely return. If it's okay with you, Brighton, I'd like to mention one way that people can start to get access. And so, you know, for those who are in Orange County or Durham or really anywhere in the state, if you're wondering how to get plugged in, feel free to call us at Alliance. We have people on an access and information line, and it's staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that number is 1-800-510-9132. That's 1-800-510-9132. And you can also, you know, find it by just going to our website.
I definitely appreciate you sharing that and hope that people will take advantage of that if they need to. And we have definitely been talking a lot more about suicide in our community because of recent events this fall, which are just tragic around our community. And I think have, again, spurred and restarted some discussions that might have died down. That sounds like an incredible resource. We were talking a little bit about telehealth as an important resource that is now growing, which is certainly encouraging. In both of your minds, where can we continue to see mental health take another step forward in terms of offering resources to people? And I'll turn back to you for this one, Dr. Schiller.
Yeah, thanks. We're actually working on a large multi-site clinical trial right now designed to improve access to therapy for pregnant and postpartum women. And the study was designed to compare telehealth to in-person treatment. I think that question has largely been answered. Many of our patients prefer telehealth. But the other part of the question was actually, can psychologists or can nurses actually provide as high quality and good of outcomes as psychologists for delivering behavioral health interventions? So that's a trial that we're doing right now, and we have no wait to get into therapy as part of the trial. So usually it's a little tricky to get in with a new treatment provider for psychotherapy, and we're offering really high quality therapy to all pregnant and postpartum women who want to join and as part of this trial right now. So I think that's where this is going next, is seeing how we can reduce barriers, not only with telehealth, but, you know, really taking a step back and thinking outside of the box. How can we provide high quality treatment even in cases where resources are typically low?
Where can people go to find out more information about that trial program?
Yeah, so we have a website. It's thesummittrial.com. And there you can find all the information you need to get into the study.
All right. And turning back to you, Dr. Moncad, in your mind, what are some of the next steps that we could see mental health resources take over the next few years in our country and general society?
Well, first of all, I feel like Dr. Schiller is sending me psychic brainwaves, because I was going to say what she was going to say, so I'll just say it again, but maybe less eloquently. There is this approach that was piloted first in the Pacific Northwest and has really expanded across the country, called collaborative care. And this is where, as Dr. Schiller was saying, you train nurses, many of whom work in primary care clinics, to screen everybody. So you come in, and again, you think you're there for your just yearly physical, but they ask you questions about how you're doing, really how you're doing. And if you screen positive, you actually start care that day with people in the primary care office. And they can serve a surprisingly large number of people if that office is trained in this technique.
You mentioned how the National Institutes of Health are helping with your research, beginning to fund that, Dr. Schiller. But is there anything that can be done with local governments, state governments, federal governments, to try and help with resources? I know, obviously, our country's relationship between government and healthcare resources, there's a variety there. But in each of your perspectives, is there anything that can be done on that front? Because we talk a lot about local government here, and it's certainly public health has been top of mind over the latest bit. But what are some steps that maybe they can take to help?
Well, I think, you know, just off the top of my head, one thing that we often talk about on my team is how to respond to behavioral health crises. And I think having more mobile crisis units and social workers who can be deployed to help respond to behavioral health crises in the community would go a long way to help reduce stigma and also reduce trauma that patients experience as they interface with law enforcement.
I imagine that's probably a similar response to yours, Dr. Moncad, especially with patients who are working through mental disabilities.
Yep, there are definitely ways to train law enforcement to do a better job. There is a program called the CIT program that can educate them, and we're happy to sponsor some of that. To answer your earlier question, and here's me speaking as a private citizen and an individual who lives in Chapel Hill, the system that we have is, first of all, not a system. It's fragmented. And it's a mess on a good day. and we haven't had a good day in a couple of years. So what we have is a disease care delivery system. What we don't have is an organized health care system. And so that's really where we need to go. And the way to get there is universal health care. And that includes things like Medicaid expansion, but it really goes further than that.
Well, I was going to say, I know Medicaid expansion is certainly a hot topic for this region when it comes to North Carolina. Not seeing that in the most recent state budget, but, you know, there are some different conversations that are going along those lines. We have a couple more minutes as we begin to wrap up here, and I want to pose this to each of you. What is one important thing that an everyday North Carolinian might not know about healthcare or mental health care or just access to healthcare that you think they certainly should know? And I want to start with you, Dr. Schiller.
Yeah, it sort of follows along with the last answer, and that there are many, many gaps in our mental health care system where people just cannot access high quality mental health care, either because of lack of access in their home community or because of a lack of affordability. And so pretty much every day I get a text or an email from someone in my own social circle asking me, help, I need to get a therapist for my teen daughter who is in crisis, or I need an evaluation for my 80-year-old father who is not doing well. How can I get access to care? And so access is the biggest thing that we have to address as a mental health field. And it's a really tricky and thorny issue because of lack of resources. For a long time, mental health care just has not been prioritized at a commensurate level to physical health care. And so as a result, we have sort of a patchwork system and many people fall through the cracks.
Same question to you, Dr. Moncad. What do you think is one important thing for an everyday North Carolinian to know about mental health care or healthcare access?
Thank you for letting us end on that topic. One thing that we didn't have a lot of time for today is to talk about wellness, which is kind of the other side of the coin of illness. And so when I think about wellness and mental health and preventing mental health, there are things that everyday North Carolinians can think about. And that's really kind of building up our resilience. In the past 2 years, I feel like I and others that I know have been making withdrawals from our resilience bank and not putting enough back in. And watching, you know, TV shows at night from a streaming service is just not enough to refill that resilience bank. And so it may sound simplistic, but regular exercise, sunshine, and most of all, meaningful connections with people you care about. Those are things that we all need to do, and we need to do them more days than not. Doctor's orders.
I bet that is something that you probably suggest to your patients too, Dr. Schiller.
Absolutely, and it's the foundation of the treatment that we're testing right now, behavioral activation therapy.
Yeah, well, thank you both again for taking the time to speak with us today. We really appreciate it, both on the chiefly on the mental health front, but also the general wellness front too. Again, we've been speaking with Dr. Crystal Schiller. You can find more of her work by searching out the UNC Health Perinatal Psychiatry Program. Dr. Mahul Moncad as well, who is with Alliance Health. You can check them out too. And that will wrap things up for our Forum on the Hill this afternoon. If you want to revisit the conversations that we have had today, you can go to chapelboro.com/forum-on-the-hill. This mental health and wellness forum will be up there soon. Our K-12 education panel from 4 to 5 will be up there soon again. Is already up there, I should say. Again, Dr. Schiller, Dr. Moncad, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
That is going to wrap things up, as I said. Be sure to stick around here on 97.9 The Hill, though. We will have a great live and local hour coming up, hosted by our own Aaron Keck. And Aaron is going to be the ones taking the reins tomorrow for our Forum on the Hill. You're going to want to tune in from 4 to 5 p.m. It will be our local housing panel. Lots of great folks that you will certainly recognize if you're a regular 97.9 The Hill listener on that panel. We will also have our region panel, our region panel. That is from 5 to 6 tomorrow here on 97.9 The Hill. Lots of familiar voices there, too. And still to come this week, many great panels, including downtown, our transit panels, higher education panels, social justice, economic development, and much more. Again, chapelboro.com/forum on the hill, the website to go to for that schedule and to listen to our audio today. I'm Brighton McConnell. That is going to do me. I'll be back tomorrow with more news on the Hill. And thank you again for listening to our first day of our 2021 Forum on the Hill.
Thanks for listening to Community Conversations on the Forum on the Hill. Presented by Alliance Health, Chapel Hill Transit, Durham Technical Community College, Grub Properties, Trinsic Residential Group, and UNC Health. Join us tomorrow at 4 p.m. to hear more discussions by local leaders on community-wide issues.